To resume the recording. Okay. I have notes. I have, brain and a pen and a class, and I think I'm good to go. Oh, and most importantly, I have a teapot full of tea. And I could do that because we're not in lab. So I guess there's some benefits, right? Let's see, any questions this morning before we get started? Anything you guys are dying to ask, figure out?
Jason, I have a question.
Yes.
Can you tell me so between the OH group and the CH3 group, which one is bigger?
Yeah, CH3 group is bigger. So the OH group, if we go back and we look in those notes, that was for the lecture component. And we go back to, let's see, where did I do that? Here, maybe? Nope. Yes. So here we have the A values that are on the hydroxyl group and the CH3. And you can see these two numbers. For hydroxyl group, it's 83% in the equatorial orientation. But when you switch to a methyl group, it switches to 95% into the equatorial orientation. That just means that the methyl group is considerably larger than the hydroxyl group.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else you guys want to ask this morning? Nope. Okay. So let's see, a couple of announcements that I've got then, and I put this out in the email, was that that Cabrillo is taking away the instructor web pages, and they're doing that for a number of different reasons why they wanted to take away those instructor web pages. That instructors were putting up a lot of PDFs and a lot of information and content that was inaccessible. And by California Ed Code, and I think it's also national, that all the information and content that we put up online needs to be accessible by all students, which means that it needs to have the correct tags in it, and it needs to have the subtitles and everything's for videos. PDFs need to be accessible by a reader, which most of the PDFs that people were putting up were not. And in order to get that into compliance was a huge issue, and Cabrillo decided that they couldn't regulate it well enough because they couldn't trust instructors to actually do the right thing. So the best thing they could do was to take away those accounts. So my web pages that I've had for years and run the class for years that way before Canvas was ever a thing, they're taking those away, and they just want everybody to be within Canvas. I think that's part of their system as well. And you can't put anything into Canvas that isn't compliant. So Canvas kind of forces that compliance. It also makes it very hard to do the type of structure that I've been doing. So, and we also can't store videos on Canvas. So the only place that we would be able to take and store our videos from these Zoom chats would be to either put them on Zoom, where you would have to access them via a link. And I don't have a whole lot of confidence in how long Zoom was going to keep those videos in place. And the other thing is YouTube, putting them on YouTube, which would work as well. However, I just like having them in a central place where I can edit them for right now, and then maybe moving them into those other locations. So what I did is I went and bought my own website, my own domain name, and I'm going to move all of the content over onto that so that I can keep that content going into the future for other classes while also making the transition into Canvas. But I don't think Canvas is going to do everything that I want it to do. So I want to keep the website kind of there too, because I like it. And that's the way I roll. So I'll be moving those over. And once I get all that transitioned over, then I'll let you guys know where that is so that you can go and see it. And what was the other thing that I needed to announce? Yeah, Canvas is still in transition. I've got grades up into Canvas. I've got your current grades uploaded into that. And I got the syllabus up into that and programmed into it. And I need to get some of the other pages, and then I will publish it, and then you guys will be able to see everything. So hopefully that'll happen this week. So that's where we are in that regard. Quizzes look like you guys were emailing me in quizzes, and that's perfect for now. I think as soon as I get Canvas up and running, I'll have you guys start moving the quizzes over into Canvas too and submitting them that way. That way there's sort of a repository and easier way for me to collect them and see them all in one place so that they don't get lost within my email. So right now what I'm trying to do is collect them all and stick them all into a file that that has quizzes written on it so I can go through and grade those and get them back to you fairly quickly. It's going to be a little bit of a learning curve and process on my end, trying to figure out how do I handle and collate all these digital files, making sure that I don't lose any of the digital files and making sure that I get them back to you in a timely manner. So that's that piece of it. Okay, I think that's all my news. So if there aren't any questions, I can see that we've got just about everybody here and everybody's ready to go. And that means that I can kind of roll into lab lecture. And we're doing distillation today. So this was an interesting challenge to think about how I wanted to do distillation, since we could not physically do it. It's more about the theory. And so I've delved a little bit deeper into the theory than I normally do. And we'll talk about glassware and how to set it all up as well. But just giving you as much of the content that I would have in class in the digital format, and going into the different types of distillations that we would do as well. So that's where I plan to go today. And with that, in distillation, I've snagged a bunch of images from Pavia as well. So all the images that I'm going to show today are out of the Pavia textbook. And I could draw these, but you know, it would just take me a long time to sit down and draw them. And those Pavia illustrations are going to be a little bit better than what I could do anyway. So we'll draw on top of these and talk about these. So distillation sort of started from the alchemical movement, and these were in the early 1600s, where they had distilled solutions using a retort and using an alembic. So the retort is a two-piece glassware. So we're looking up here at this top piece, the retort, where you just heated a vessel, a glass-shaped vessel that had a long arm on it, and materials would boil and then flow as a gas through the long arm. And this arm here worked as a condenser. And then you would have the receiving flask that it would flow into. The alembic down below, the alembic was a three-piece, and the condenser sat on top of the alembic flask. So the condenser was here. And so you move things from the liquid phase into the gas phase. They condense on this piece of glassware that was exposed to a large amount of air. And then as the liquid would recondense, or the vapors would recondense back into a liquid, they would flow into the receiving flask. And so out of this, there were a couple of different designs. So if we're looking at the retort design morphed into the late 1800s into more of what we would think of a distillation apparatus. But what they used is cork connections. And so these cork connections, you can see the different corks here. They didn't have ground glass joints. Everything was put together with corks and little short pieces of glassware. But the distillation apparatus was much the same, except what they had was they had a water flowing in and out of a condenser. And that was a double-walled condenser. So that essentially what's happening in that double-walled condenser is that water is flowing into this thing, and that water basically flows in here and goes around this outer wall. And the inner wall is the glass tubing that goes all the way through that does not contact actually physically the water. Oh, I'm not sharing the screen. I thought I did share screen. Hey, Anne.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just figured it out.
Oh, okay. Cool. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
I wanted to make sure. Okay. So everybody can see the screen, right? I am screen sharing. We're all good. That would be embarrassing for me to get going. Okay. Thanks, Sarah. So that's the what's called a water jacketed condenser. And that allowed us to use a cooling water that made the distillation much more effective because you can condense your boiling liquid, your boiling vapors much more easily using that cool water. And that's where that came from. And then that morphed into a traditional type of distillation where now we have ground glass joints. So within this, these joints here are all ground glass. And this is sort of the classic distillation apparatus where all of these are standard tapered joints. And still we have the water that can flow into this and out of this thing. Excuse me. So water goes in, water comes back out. And we just connect water tubing to that and flow the water through that piece of glassware. And the most important difference, I think, when you look at these is a really critical difference right here. This thing was open. The receiving flask was basically a Erlenmeyer beaker. And the Erlenmeyer beaker was open such that air could escape that thing. Over here, they have a vacuum port, or what they call a vacuum port. But when a vacuum is not connected to it, it's open. And that means that this entire apparatus is open to the atmosphere such that as pressure develops, the pressure can release and come out that open vacuum port. And that's really critical because if you close off that vacuum port, you don't have a distillation. What you have is a bomb. As you heat it up, vapors expand. As the vapors expand, it creates tremendous pressure within the glassware, and the glassware can just explode. So one of the first checks that we do whenever we're setting up a distillation apparatus is we make sure that we always have an opening like that vacuum port so that as we start to heat this thing, we don't explode it. And then that traditional sort of organic scale morphed into microscale, where we have really efficient types of distillation apparatuses. And this has both the water jacketed condenser where water can go in and out, and the ground glass joint. So water goes in, water comes out inside that little jacket. The vacuum port is down here on the side. So here's our vacuum port. That allows everything to be open. And everything is hooked up with a ground glass joint, including the thermometer, which is set inside there with a ground glass joint. And the only thing that they have wrong on this image, well, actually, maybe it's not wrong. I think that looks okay, is the height of the thermometer bulb. And we'll talk a little bit about the height of the thermometer bulb and where that bulb sits, that you want that bulb to sit exactly at the height where your liquid is and vapor are transitioning from one another so that it's at the height of the phase change. And that's occurring right at the beginning of the condenser. And what that allows you to do is that allows you to measure the temperature of the phase change, which is what you're interested in because that's the boiling point of the liquid itself. So the boiling point, the distillation material that's coming over needs to be measured at the transition point from vapor to liquid. And that is always right at the beginning of that condenser. So we'll look and we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. On the other side, when we look at the alembic, those three pieces of glassware sort of transitioned into a different type of distillation apparatus. And these are still in use. We use these for solvent extraction, for purifying solvents, different than the other distillations. This is sort of a constant distilling apparatus because it allows liquid to go back in. So one of the things that's happening here is that this is the receiving flask. And it allows for liquid to build up and to reflow back down. And so it allows for recirculation of the solvent. And these types of apparatuses are called stills. And we use them for distilling solvents and for cleaning up solvents. And we can then pull the solvent out using the stopcock valve there and allow the distillation to continue going to produce more solvent as we need to. We can then turn these off, keep these closed up and set up, and we can turn them on and distill solvent as we need to. And so these are frequently used in air sensitive types of labs where where the still just remains set up in order to keep solvents dry and to produce clean solvent on demand is sort of the way that that works. And the condenser is more of a vertical condenser, which is kind of cool. And that sets up for our sort of modern microscale, which is, hang on a second, I'm going to put my computer into, there we go. I'll prevent texts and things from coming through. The microscale uses our small microscale glassware with like the 5 mil conical vials or the 3 mil conical vials and the Hickman still, which is set up in the same sort of way. What this does is it allows vapors. So we can imagine that vapors would come up through this from the boiling material, hit the condenser. The water jacketed condenser has water that goes in and out. So H2O in and out. And then once that liquid condenses, it flows down back in and gets trapped into the reservoir of the Hickman still. And the only way to get it back out is some of the Hickman stills have a port that are on the side of them. So sometimes there's a little port that sits here with a little cap that fits on it. And you can go in through the side port with a pipette and to remove the liquid, or you have to remove the condenser and then stick a pipette down the Hickman still into that little side reservoir to be able to get the liquid out. But all of these are doing the same sort of thing. They are doing a phase transition, taking a liquid, boiling it, converting it into a gas, sending it to a condenser, and then trapping it into a new part of the glassware. That's the way that distillation works. So distillation is about separations of mixtures, mostly, and purification. Why is the top of the H2O out and the bottom valve in for the air condenser? Water. Okay, so you always want to work against gravity. If we take a condenser and we look at the two types of condensers that we can use, so we can have two setups of condensers. Let me zoom out just a little bit. We can have the double-walled jacketed condenser. And inside of this, you have that secondary wall. So you can get this to snap in. Okay, and then this guy goes down to a ground glass piece of joint that fits here. And at the top, we have the same sort of thing. That should be a ground glass joint. So let's clean that ground glass joint up. Okay, water goes in, always at the bottom, at the low end. So H2O in at low end, and always H2O out the top. And that happens that way because if we did it the other way, this way, water, as water goes in, make that a slightly larger pin. As water goes into this thing, wrong pin, it fills up from the bottom up and fills all the way up the top. And you get no air gap in it. If we take it and we fill it the other direction, if we reverse it, and we try to put the water in the top and out the bottom, what winds up happening is it'll look like this. Water will flow in, but will only fill up part of the condenser, and you get a big air gap. And that air gap is just not as efficient when you get an air gap like that inside it, because it doesn't start condensing until hitting down lower in the condenser. So we always work against gravity. So this way is wrong, this way is correct, and we work against gravity. It's more extreme when the condenser is a vertical condenser, that if you fill it from the top, the water just sort of trickles down and doesn't bathe the entire piece of glassware. So that's why it's always set up that way. Water is always in the bottom and out the top. Does that catch it, Katrina? Okay. So where we go from here, we've kind of gone over the glassware. Let's look at two component mixtures and the types of temperature versus time behavior that we see. So what we're going to look at is distillation and temperature versus time. Time meaning over the course of the distillation. So what we want to have is we want to have a graph here that is going to have time moving forward and temperature on the y-axis. And if it's just a single component, let's say single substance, we'll just call it A, then what happens is as you distill, you come up to the boiling point and then it distills at the boiling point. And this is A only. And this temperature that we're recording is the boiling point. When you change that to a two component mixture, you can get a couple of different pictures that can happen. So let's take this and move it over. And let's look at a two component mixture. And we'll do a couple of different graphs. I don't have a whole lot of room because I was writing kind of big, so we'll keep them a little bit apart. And this is time and temp. And this is two component. With A and B, where these are close and boiling point. In this case, what the mixture looks like is the mixture sort of has an increasing bridge. This is the boiling point of A. And up here, we've got the boiling point of B. And what we wind up getting is sort of a mixture of A and B coming out together as that goes on. In the next one, and usually that slope is not quite as pronounced. Let me try that one more time. I got a little, usually what we see is it's not quite so clean. It's a little bit more like that. This is a two component with A and B, where they're very different boiling points. In this case, what we wind up seeing is that we really do get a distillation and then a shooting up of temperature, and then and you can get two different materials coming out very cleanly. So here what we do is when we do a distillation for the two component that are close in boiling point, we don't get very good separation out of the materials. The materials are hard to separate because their boiling points are so similar. And so we get sort of a continual rise in boiling point and a mixture of the two materials. But when the two materials, A and B, have very different boiling points, then we can resolve those materials and we can separate them based on their boiling point. And that's what we want to try to understand is, and this is sort of ideal and in good situation. And we need to understand why these materials are not able to separate when they have close boiling points, but when they're very different boiling points, why we can separate them. And so it goes all back to the boiling point. We need to talk about boiling points for a second. So the question that I would ask before we even get into the rest of this is, what is the definition of boiling point? So the third graph is more ideal. Yes, the third graph, Rodrigo, is more ideal. It's what we would ideally want in terms of separations, is that we would like to get A coming out consistently all by itself, and then a sharp change in temperature, and B coming out consistently all by itself. And that way we can separate out the two materials and we would capture them in different flasks. You can think about going back to TLC, that when we did TLC and we were trying to resolve spots, that if the two spots were too close to each other, that you couldn't resolve them. But when they had big enough polarity differences, we could separate them cleanly and see them cleanly. And if we were doing column chromatography, in the first situation, the spots would be mixed and we wouldn't be able to get a clean spot. In the second situation, the spots would be far apart from one another and we would be able to capture them in different test tubes and we could separate them out. So that's sort of the comparison with TLC, just in terms of being able to separate out the mixtures. Okay, so boiling point. You know what the boiling point is. You know that the boiling point of a material is just where you physically see it boil. But what is the boiling point actually? There's a definition of what the boiling point is, or there's a definition of when a material boils. Do you guys remember what that definition is? Anybody want to chime in there and either text it to me or unmute the mic for a second and shoot it at me? When it becomes a gas, yeah, Kylie, yes, it is the transition, it's the phase transition, but when does that transition occur? There's a specific way of knowing when that transition is going to occur. Like when we're heating something up, how high do we have to heat it in order to get it to boil? Anybody remember that part?
I think it has something to do with the vapor pressure.
Yeah, it does have to do with the vapor pressure. Francisco, do you remember what it has to do with the vapor pressure or how that works?
I think it's something like there has to be a difference in the vapor pressure. Nah, I don't remember.
Okay, well you're on the right track. All right, so what happens is if we take a look at a liquid, so let's put a liquid into a container. Let's just throw it into a beaker here. And we've got a liquid that's sitting in here. Okay, and what is pushing on this liquid is the pressure of the atmosphere. So the pressure of the atmosphere is pushing down on that liquid. And the liquid itself, what it's doing is that liquid is evaporating and has a pressure of vapor, the vapor pressure that exists over that. So what that means is that for every liquid, there is a certain amount of vapor that sits over that liquid. And that amount of vapor pressure is determined by the intermolecular attractive forces and how weak or how strong they are. The weaker the forces, the higher the vapor pressure. So we could say the weaker the IMF forces, the stronger or the higher the vapor pressure. And conversely, the stronger IMFs, the lower the vapor pressure. And if we think about a gas bubble, so let's just look at a bubble here and say this is a gas bubble. I was trying to do one that was round. There we go. And this is inside this gas bubble. What we have is we have the pressure. We have pressure of the gas, and that pressure of the gas is pushing out everywhere to extend this bubble. And what's pushing on the bubble is the pressure of the atmosphere. So we can think of three different situations. We can think of a situation where we have the pressure of the gas is less than the pressure of the atmosphere. We could have the pressure of the gas is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere, or we could have the pressure of the gas is greater than the pressure of the atmosphere. In the first case, what we have where the pressure of the gas is less than the pressure of the atmosphere, the bubble will collapse. And the bubble collapsing when it collapses, that means that the bubble is not allowed to form and there's no boiling. We can have evaporation. So evaporation can occur at that point, but we don't have any actual boiling at that point. When the pressure of the gas is equal to the atmosphere, this is the boiling point. This is where a bubble is allowed to form, and this is what we define as the actual boiling point of a material. A material boils when the pressure of its vapor is equal to the atmospheric pressure pushing on it. That's when the gas bubble can actually form, and then we see those bubbles erupting out of the solution. If the pressure of the gas is greater than the pressure of the atmosphere, this is where we get explosive boiling. This is what we call bumping. This is a superheated solution. And we get bumping, which is explosive boiling. It's just where everything just comes flying out at you. So the boiling point of a liquid is where the pressure, the vapor pressure of the gas is equal to the atmospheric pressure. And you know that the pressure of the gas is proportional to temperature. So vapor pressure is proportional to temperature. So let's say vapor pressure is proportional to temperature. And as temperature goes up, the vapor pressure of a liquid goes up. And as we continue to heat it, eventually the vapor pressure will become equal to the atmospheric pressure. And when the vapor pressure becomes equal to atmospheric, then the material will actually boil. And if we reduce the vapor, if we reduce the atmospheric pressure artificially, we can cause liquids to boil at any temperature that we want. So we can take water, which is really cool, and you can put a vacuum on the water. And as you reduce the atmospheric pressure, you can actually cause the water to boil itself just due to reducing the atmospheric pressure on it. I've actually got a video. I'm wondering if it's worth it to show you and take a minute to show you, where I've got a beaker of water inside a vacuum chamber, and I use the vacuum and reduce the pressure on it, and we can actually see it boiling. The question is whether or not I can find it fast enough. Let me see where I've got it hidden and see if I can pull this forward so that you guys can see it. So you're not gonna see what I'm doing for a second, because I'm gonna try and look for a file that's on my computer rather than on my iPad. And of course, I'm not going to be able to find it, because I didn't actually think that I would want that. There it is. All right, let me dump out a screen sharing here for a minute and screen share my computer and see if I can show you this video screen share on the computer. So I need to go to Zoom, stop broadcasting, dump out of that for a second, start screen sharing here. So it's harder than I thought it was. Okay, that's not gonna work. You know what, I'll set it up and I'll show you that later. I have to actually quit out of Zoom in order to give my computer access to screen share it. And I don't have it. Yeah, I'll bring that up. I'll show it to you next class and I'll set it all up so that I can do that. That's going to be the easier way. I don't want to stop the Zoom just to be able to show that, because that would kick everybody out and then everybody would have to log back in. Okay, so we'll just go back to lecture. So anyway, the boiling point of a liquid is when its vapor pressure equals atmospheric pressure. And I want to make sure, okay, can everybody see the screen again? I'm back up and everything's looking okay, and I'm back on the same screen that I was. Thanks, Rodrigo. Okay, cool. So now let's take this concept and let's apply this concept to a mixture of liquids so that we have a couple of different materials in solution. We have two component mixture, A and B. And so we have this liquid that's inside here, and the liquid is a two component mixture, A plus B. And so we have a bunch of A's in here and a bunch of B's in here, just representing the two materials. And what we're going to say is that the vapor pressure of component A is equal to the vapor pressure of component B. So that, actually, I'm doing it the wrong way. I always do it that way. I always say V and then I put P, but it's the pressure of the vapor of A and the pressure of the vapor of B are equivalent to one another. And what that means is that when I look above this system, I have these little gas particles, A, and the gas particle A here, and B as a gas is hanging out here, and that the number of gas particles are equal to each other because their vapor pressures are equal to each other. How do you create bumping reaction? Yeah, Jorge, yeah, we're not gonna let you make a bomb. Bumping is a situation, I'm gonna talk about that when we start looking at the setup. I'll talk about bumping. But bumping is something generally to try to avoid, because if you overheat a vessel or you reduce the pressure on the vessel when it's already hot, the possibility is you can actually explode the apparatus, that the boiling can become so strong that it can actually break the glassware with the pressure changes that are occurring within the vessel all of a sudden. And so, yeah, it's something that we want to talk about, and we will, but when we talk about setups, we'll hit that specifically. Okay, so let's look at a two-component mixture where the vapor pressures are not equal. So what I've got now is a system where the pressure of the vapor of A is greater than the pressure of the vapor of B. And we have an equal mixture. They're 50-50, so we'll have B and B. We'll throw another B down here. We've got A and A and A. They're all equal. And let's do it this way too. I can hit B and B, and just showing that they're equal, and A, that they're equal. We'll hit our A's and our B's. It actually just kind of highlights it out nicely. But what winds up happening here is that because the vapor pressure of A is higher, that means that there must be more molecules of A that are in the gas phase in order for its vapor pressure to be higher. Because remember that a vapor pressure is proportional to the number of moles that are giving rise to that gas, PV equals NRT. So the pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles of gas that are there. And so we can go back and we can say PV equals NRT, the ideal gas law, and that pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles that are in the system. And so if the pressure of the system is higher, then it is also true that the number of moles that are giving rise to that must be higher. So that's where that comes from, is the ideal gas law. And let's see, A was red. So let's go back and grab the red marker and we'll hit these. And then let's throw one more in there, A as a gas particle. And then B is also in here, the B constituent as a gas, but there's far fewer of those moles because its vapor pressure is lower. So the number of moles is lower. Now, what I could do is if I could think about a way that I could go in and sequester this gas and then condense that gas, if I could condense it into a separate container, then what I would have is I would literally have a mixture that now has more A in it than B. So what do I have? Five of the A's. So I've got A, 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 and A, and just a couple of B's that are in there. And you can imagine that if I could trap this into a new beaker, that I have now enriched this material in A, and I have purified A to some degree, that I have removed a certain amount of B, if I could condense it. And that's what distillation literally does. Distillation is using the differences in vapor pressure to purify a material into its vapor state, and then to capture that vapor, condense it back into a liquid, and we then have a different constituency in the liquid form than we had in the original mixture. And that's why distillation works. And you can imagine that if we could do this more than once, that if I could do this boiling, capture, condense, boil, capture, condense, and I could do this successively multiple times, that I could purify the material and I could get A all by itself, just using the vapor pressures to change and capture a different mixture. So that's the heart of what distillation is it uses those vapor pressures. And we'll look at that in a little more detail too, but let's look at a phase diagram and how this looks in terms of a phase diagram. So a phase diagram looks at a two-component mixture. And what we do is we start off defining some axis points. So this is going to be a mole fraction of A. So we're going to have 100%. This is A, and A is going to go down to 80, 60, 40, 20, and eventually down to zero. B is going to start out at 100% and go down to 80 and 60, 40, 20, and zero. And so this x-axis right now, this is the mole percent of the solution, of the mixture. And we have temperature that is on the y-axis. And if we think about B as being the higher boiling material, and we put the boiling point of B up here, and so that material boils, and we'll say that this is the boiling point of B all the way out there, and boiling point of A is a lower boiling material, so we'll put the boiling point of A over here, down low. And that's that point. Then what we can do is we can draw a graph that has, oh, I'm going to choose wrong colors here. I'm going to choose purple. And it gets sort of football shaped a little bit. I think I chose the wrong color there again. I don't want that to be mixing up between A and B, because these are still mixtures, these lines. But what these lines are, is this is the liquid composition. And the top line that is the purple line is the vapor composition. So let's say that we have a material that has 10% of A and 90% of B. So let's say that this is our starting spot right here. And we've got 10% A and 90% B. That material is going to boil at this point. So this is the boiling point of mixture. But when that material boils, what happens is its vapor composition is determined by the horizontal line, and that's the vapor composition. And the composition in the vapor then comes down to here. And so this is the composition of vapor. That composition of vapor is now looking like it's about, 45% and 55%. So this is looking like 45% of A and now 55% of B. And it's been enriched in A. And if we could do that multiple times, if we could boil that again and then condense it, and then boil it and condense it, and I do that enough times, eventually I will get over to 100% A and 0% B. And so depending upon the phase diagram and what the phase diagram looks like, each one of these points in the phase diagram is called a theoretical plate. So this point right here, this is called a theoretical plate. A theoretical plate is a theoretical point where you transition from liquid to vapor. And it's as if I was using different apparatuses. I boil the liquid, capture the gas, condense it back into a liquid, put it into another container, boil it again, capture the gas, condense it back into a liquid, put it in a different container. Each one of these theoretical plates is doing that. But the theoretical plates don't necessarily have to be a different apparatus. A theoretical plate can be a point in an apparatus where liquid is phase transitioning, going from liquid to gas, back to liquid, back to gas. Each place where that happens within the apparatus is called a theoretical plate. And the more theoretical plates you can produce within an apparatus, the better the separation will be within the mixture. So first off, any questions on that phase diagram before I continue on with that? You guys are understanding what I'm doing there in terms of theoretical plates, just in namesake of a theoretical plate, and it's a point of transition between liquid and gas, and that the more times I can do that, the more I can purify a liquid. And these curves are based on the boiling point difference of the two materials. So if I know the boiling point of A and I know the boiling point of B, then I can figure out what this curve is. We're not gonna do that. We're not gonna do that type of work, but that's where these curves come from. And that mole fraction, let's understand what a mole fraction is really quickly. So the mole fraction of A, when we say a mole fraction, the mole fraction of A is equal to what we say is Na, and this is equal to the moles of A divided by the moles of A plus the moles of B. And then if we multiply that by 100 and we take Na times 100, this equals the mole percent. And we could do the same thing for B. So if I want the mole fraction of B, B is equal to NB, and that's equal to the moles of B divided by the moles of A plus B. And then if I take NB times 100, I'll get its mole percent. Oops, that was supposed to be times. All right, so those are the mole percents. Within this, what we have is a law called Raoult's Law. And Raoult's Law basically states that the vapor composition is related to the composition, to the liquid composition for ideal liquids. And so this says that the vapor composition is related to liquid composition. For an ideal liquids. And there are non-ideal liquids. We're going to talk a little bit about non-ideal liquids too, a little bit later. But basically what we say here is that the partial vapor pressure of component A in solution is equal to the vapor pressure of pure A times its mole fraction. So the way that we word that is that, we'll write it out in words first and then we'll do it mathematically. The partial vapor pressure of component A in solution, and this is PA, is equal to the vapor pressure of A. We will call that, and that's pure A. I don't want to say just A. Actually, I want to get that word in there that this is, where do I want it? I want it over here. Pure A. That is with the little not symbol up there. That's what the not is there for. Multiplied by its mole fraction. So we state that the pressure of A is equal to its pure pressure times its mole fraction. That's the statement. And the pressure of B is equal to the vapor pressure of B, pure B, times its mole fraction. This is basically a restatement of what we drew back here when we were looking at vapor pressures and we were looking at how many of the gas particles were in the gas phase for A and B, and that we said that they were related to their vapor pressures. That is exactly what Raoult's law is doing for us mathematically. It's just stating it that the partial pressure of A is equal to its pure vapor pressure times its mole fraction. And that if I take a look and say that the pressure total of a system is equal to, this is Dalton's law of partial pressures. You guys remember Dalton's law of partial pressures in the PV equals NRT section, Chem 1A and Chem 1B. We would say that the pressure total is equal to the partial pressures of component one plus the pressure of component two plus however many there are, that the total pressure of a system is equal to the sum of the partial pressures. That's Dalton's law of partial pressure. So if we take that and we take a two-component mixture, then we could say that the pressure total in the system is equal to the pressure of A plus the pressure of B, and that is equal to the vapor pressure of A times its mole fraction plus the vapor pressure of B times its mole fraction. And that at boiling, that is going to be equal to the atmospheric pressure. So at the boiling point, then the pressure of the atmosphere is going to be equal to the vapor pressure of A times its mole fraction plus the vapor pressure of B times its mole fraction for boiling. And that allows us to actually be able to then do computations and to be able to figure out what those mole fractions actually are, knowing what their vapor pressures are. But we can also say and look at that and know that that if a material has a very high vapor pressure, then it's also going to have a very high mole fraction that is in the concentration there, that the mole fraction of that with a higher vapor pressure is going to be higher. And that allows us to enrich a material that has a higher vapor pressure. And that's where this whole thing goes. So if we take that part and we look at boiling point difference versus plates, theoretical plates needed to achieve a separation. This gives us an idea that if this is the difference in boiling points and the number of plates that are needed to achieve separation, if we've got a 108 degree difference, we only need one plate. If we have a 72 degree difference, we need two plates. If we have a 54 degree difference, we need three plates. And it keeps going up. The closer we get the difference, the more theoretical plates we actually need. 36 degrees needs 5, 20 needs 10. You get down to a 10 degree difference and you need 20 theoretical plates. You get down to a 7, a 4, and a 2 degree difference. At 7 degrees, we need 30 theoretical plates. At 4 degrees, we need 50 theoretical plates. And at 2 degrees, we need 100 theoretical plates. The more, the closer the boiling points of the two materials, the more theoretical plates you need. So how does that translate? What does that mean in terms of doing a distillation? When we do a distillation, let me grab an image to show you. Where did I hide those? Work, triple scan. I want, not that one. Huh, it's the one that I didn't take a picture of. Okay, we'll draw it. When you have a column, and we have a ground glass joint here and a round bottom connected to this and a distillation that's going on and we're applying heat to this thing and this is distilling. What winds up happening is on the sides of the column, you get condensation. And that condensation is a transition, a phase transition from gas to liquid. As you heat the system up, that material re-vaporizes and goes back into the gas phase. So let's say that the gas phase here is the red color. So what I'm doing is I'm coming up in gas phase and then it condenses down into a liquid and I get liquid on the wall. That liquid then, as soon as it heats up, goes back into a gas phase and then condenses out on the wall. That then goes back into the gas phase as it heats up and condenses out in the wall. Each one of these places where I'm getting condensation and then revaporization, those are the individual theoretical plates. The way that you can achieve more theoretical plates is by two processes. More theoretical plates are proportional to the height of the column. And the number of plates is also proportional to surface area. So I can increase the number of theoretical plates by two processes. I can go to a longer column that will give me more theoretical plates, or I can increase the surface area interaction, which will encourage condensation and then revaporization with the more surface area that I have. And that creates a couple of different column designs. And we choose the column based on how close the two materials are in boiling point that we are trying to separate. So if the two materials have very large differences in boiling point, then we can use a really short column with not much surface area. But if I have boiling points that are really close, like a 2 degree difference in boiling points, then I need a very long column and a whole lot of surface area. And the way that they do that is by taking and doing a couple of different column designs. So this is a picture that I want to grab. We'll bring this over so that we can draw on it. So these are different ways of getting surface area. The height is easy to understand because the height, you could just change the height of the column. But how do you change the surface area in a column? That's what we kind of want to look at. So this type of tube over here on A is called a Vigorex column. And what they have done is they have taken a tool while the glassware was hot and inserted a tool into the glass and created a divot. And each one of these little divots or spikes increases the surface area and increases the number of theoretical plates within the column. So while you could look at it and you could say each one of these areas where there are divots is a single theoretical plate, that is not in actuality true. There are more theoretical plates than just the number of divot patterns that are in this. It's just adding more surface area in order to create those more theoretical plates. The problem with these columns is that they're a little bit hard to clean. You can't get a brush down them to clean them, but they do work extraordinarily well. And most of the columns that we have within OCHEM that are small sort of distillation columns are these types with these little divots that are in them. The other way is to do a packed column. And what you do is you put a small amount of steel sponge in it, and then there's different packing materials that you can use. You can use glass tubing sections, you can use glass beads, stainless steel sponge can be crammed in there. All of these things create additional surface area and create more theoretical plates for better separation. And they have some other column designs too, where they will actually have spiral pieces of glass that go down through the column. And those spiral pieces of glass can sometimes rotate, and they'll rotate those counter to the flow of the gas coming through. And that can increase the number of theoretical plates as well. Those aren't as common anymore. These are the two most common ways of increasing theoretical plates, is to just increase the surface area within the column. Okay. Let's see. So practical points. Some practical points when setting up a distillation. Let's look at another image that they had of a distillation set up in here. This one. So this is how to set up a distillation practically. No, one more time. Okay. This distillation apparatus that they have set up here, they've got a pretty good clamping system on it. They've got three different clamps. They've got a clamp that is, let's switch to red. They've got a clamp that is here on the neck. They've got a clamp here on the condenser, and they've got a clamp on the receiving flask. For me, this is problematic, that while they have all these clamps in place and they show you how to set this up, and notice that they have the water going in the bottom and out the top, and they also have the vacuum port open. All those things are good, but the clamping system in this sucks. When a distillation is running, you need to be able to control the distillation at any point in case of emergency. And you need to also be able to switch out the receiving flask. And at times, you may need to do something with the distilling flask in case of an emergency. And the clamping system that they've done here that they're showing doesn't allow for any of that. So when I set up a distillation, the way that I like to set this up, and I just have to draw this separately because there's no other way to do this, is to make sure that when I have my round bottom, and that's hooked up to, they've got just a short condenser on this. I'm going to go with a slightly longer condenser. I don't like to clamp it on the round bottom itself. That clamping it on the round bottom leads to issues. You can't drop down the round bottom or move the round bottom as you need to. So what I encourage you to do is, we usually have some sort of heating apparatus. We'll talk about different types of heating apparatuses. I put a jack stand in underneath this. A jack stand is an apparatus that allows this to be able to go up and down as a scissors lift. That allows me to move the heat and adjust the heat height as I need to. Also inside of this, we have a thermometer that sits just at the right height. So the thermometer goes in there. And then there is a downturn and an exit port over here. And then this hooks up to the round bottom that is the receiving flask. And then what I normally do is take and put a second jack stand that is up higher that supports the receiving flask as well, so that I can drop that down and remove the receiving flask if I want to. Water goes in, water comes out. And in terms of clamping, the way that I like to clamp things is I like to clamp them on the column, at the base of the column, specifically not on the flask, but at the base of the column. And the other place that I like to clamp is I like to clamp at the total other end of the condenser. And this is not on the receiving flask. That allows you to be able to remove the receiving flask as you need to in order to take fractions. So you can drop down the jack stand and you can remove the receiving flask if you need to. And you can also drop down the jack stand and remove the heat and remove the still pot if you need to. That's the distillation flask apparatus if you need to. And the reason that I clamp in these two sections is because what I'm trying to create is I'm trying to create the biggest triangle I can create. That from an engineering and a physics standpoint, triangles are very strong, rigid structures. The larger the triangle you can create with your clamping apparatus, the more rigid and well-held the apparatus is going to be. Certainly, I could throw on a third clamp up high if I wanted to. But within the OCHEM class, the problem is that we don't have all of the clamps that we would need for everybody to set up all these distillation apparatuses. We start running out of clamps. And so clamping with two clamps at the base of the column and at the end of the condenser are the two best places to clamp in order to make that really strong triangle and to make a really rigid system. And it still allows you to move everything. Now the heating comes from a couple of different types of heating systems. When you're heating something, the way that we heat them is with, ideally, what's called a heating mantle. A heating mantle is a piece of sort of like glass fabric. It's almost like fiberglass that has a heating element inside of it. And that heating element plugs into a little device called a rheostat, which then plugs into the wall. It's a voltage regulator. And this one is the heating mantle. The benefits are that the heating mantles are sized for the specific glassware that you're using. So if you're using a 25 mil round bottom or 50 mil round bottom or 100 or 1,000 mil round bottom, that there are heating mantles that are designed to fit specifically around those round bottoms, such that the round bottom really nestles down into the apparatus and gets heated very specifically there, and you can control the heat really tightly with the heating mantle. Those things are great, but they're really expensive. What a lot of people tend to use is an oil bath. Oil baths have a problem. So on an oil bath, what they do is they take and they put a hot plate down, and you have the spinning sort of hot plate. The oil bath is usually made out of a piece of glassware that just contains oil in it, and the round bottom sits in the hot oil. The problem with this is that when you use a water jacketed condenser, the water jacketed condenser sometimes, not that it leaks, but that condensation happens from the water jacketed condenser. And so that if I've got my column and my round bottom sitting down here, and I'm sitting inside an oil bath, and I'm heating this thing up, and there's hot oil in here, if any water falls from the water jacketed condenser, and there's tubing that is on this thing that is adding water into it, if any water drips and it hits the hot oil, it's like water hitting oil on your stove. It causes the oil to explosively eject out oil, which oftentimes will catch fire as soon as it hits the hot plate. And then the whole thing goes up in fire. And I can't tell you how many fume hoods I saw go up in flames in grad school, exactly because of this issue of trying to use an oil bath to heat a distillation apparatus inappropriately, or a chemical reaction where they were using a condenser and the oil bath just goes up in flames and it takes the whole fume hood with it and the whole apparatus. So I have always been sort of negative on oil baths. And what we do within the OCHEM class is we use a sand bath. So what I generally instruct students to do is to take the round bottom, whatever size round bottom it is that you're going to use, and find a beaker, the right size beaker that the round bottom can fit within. Once you find the right size beaker, take the beaker, lay the beaker on its side, and with the beaker on its side, take some aluminum foil and roll the aluminum foil around the beaker. And usually what I do is, I don't have it go quite out that far. I usually only have the aluminum foil up about as high as about half the height of the beaker. And then once I roll this around the beaker, you stand the beaker up. And now what you have is you have aluminum foil that is very tightly wound around this. And you kind of smash down the bottom so it's flat. And then you remove the beaker out of it. And what you're left with after you remove the beaker out of it is this very nicely shaped, smooth aluminum dish. That we can make a sand bath out of. The reason that I do it out of aluminum is that we generally want to put a spin vane inside the chemical reaction of distillation that we're doing in order to keep it from bumping and to keep it mixing. And I find that those spin vanes don't connect through any other type of metal that I have tried, and that we want to heat this pretty high, and I don't want to have the chance of the glass breaking. I also don't want to have the glass breaking and have sand go everywhere. So using a beaker as the sand bath doesn't work real well either, but the aluminum seems to be just perfect. And so what we generally set up is we generally set up the aluminum sand bath. We have the round bottom, which is the pot that goes into this. We put sand up so that the sand sits inside this. This sits on top of a stirring hot plate. The stirring hot plate then sits on top of a jack stand and allows the whole thing to be able to move up and down. And then we put a spin vane inside here instead of putting boiling stones in it, because we want it to boil, but we don't want it to bump. So the spin vane helps to make sure that the whole thing doesn't bump and that it boils appropriately. And then we've got our column that goes into this. So we can do it this way. And then from there, we've got the condenser and the rest of the apparatus.
Jason, I have a question.
Go for it.
Are the spin valves or spin vanes, are they covered in something like Teflon? Because
they are indeed
plastic.
Yeah, actually, they are Teflon material. And the that's actually a really good question. They are Teflon. Uh-oh, pad froze. Hold on. Francisco, they are Teflon. And the thing about that is that it depends upon what it is that you're distilling. And I have had times where I have distilled certain materials or done chemical reactions with certain materials that actually will attack the Teflon, in which case I made my own stir bars. What I did is I took the Teflon ones, cut the magnets out of them, and then I embedded those magnets into a glass tube and sealed the two ends of the glass tube up and made glass stir rods. So you can actually have glass spin vanes that'll do the same thing. But yeah, they're generally Teflon. And so this is the whole distillation setup and the clamping system, where we would clamp low on the condenser, on the column, and low down on the condenser, clamping there. And that's basically your whole setup. Now, the only issue with this is that when you do a column that is a fairly long column, that it can take a very long time for this thing to heat. So one of the problems that we find is that it takes a long time to heat a long column. And in order to get around that, what I typically do is with long columns like this, I'll take aluminum foil and I will put aluminum foil around this whole piece here and create sort of like a chimney, and then close the aluminum foil up at the top. And what that does is that convects the heat up the sides so that the heat from the hot plate will now carry up and heat the glassware and cause the distillation to go more efficiently. If you don't do that, sometimes that column can act as a condenser and the distillation will never go. But if you heat it efficiently and wrap it, and sometimes what they'll do is they'll wrap it with glass wool and then put aluminum foil around the glass wool, basically making insulation around it, and getting that and making sure that it's capturing all the heat from the sand bath, then the distillation goes much, much more smoothly. The only problem here now is a really critical thing that when we start distilling, there are two things to check. So two checks. Number one, always make sure that the system is open. So that opening is right here. That's the open port. That thing needs to be open. Otherwise, it's a bomb. Second thing, never distill to dryness. In the distillation pot. That can also make a bomb. And so what we typically do is we typically put a window in the aluminum foil so that we can actually look into it and see when the flask is going dry. So why does distilling to dryness cause things to explode? With a lot of different solvents, particularly ether solvents, so let's look at diethyl ether for a second. Diethyl ether plus oxygen and heat accelerates it, makes what's called an organoperoxide. And the act of heating these things can accelerate the formation of peroxides. But more so, these materials tend to be solids. They don't tend to be liquids. And when they are in liquid, they are stable. So when you take an organoperoxide and you have solvent around that organoperoxide, the organoperoxide is generally pretty stable. But when it goes dry, they become explosive and they become contact explosives. And so oftentimes it is extremely dangerous to distill down to dryness because of the possibility of there being explosive materials in small concentration that remain once you distill to dryness. And these formations of these peroxides with certain solvents are a real and ever-present danger. And oftentimes, this just happens upon sitting. Sometimes what you'll do is you'll come upon a bottle in a lab where this used to happen when we weren't so careful, where this was an ether solvent. And what you'll see is that you'll have the ether inside it, and then you'll have a ground glass joint or a lid or something to that nature, and there will be crystals on the side of the lid. And these crystals that can happen on the side of the lid, both inside and around the lid, these solid crystals of peroxide, not hydrogen peroxide, but the organoperoxide. And when you try to remove the lid, it detonates the entire bottle. So anytime you see an ether bottle that has solids either in the bottle, around the lid, we never even move it off the shelf. What we do is we call the bomb squad, and we actually have the bomb squad come out, remove the bottle, and detonate the bottle as if it were a bomb, because that's how sensitive those explosives can actually be. And there's been plenty of people that have been really injured by peroxides forming, particularly with ether solvents. So never distill to dryness, and always make sure that there is an open atmospheric port on that guy so that you don't have a bomb. Those are the two main things in terms of doing the distillation. Let's see, what else can I tell you? Any questions?
Have you assigned lab questions for last week's?
I did not. I got halfway into them and I got distracted by trying to get Canvas up and running. So that's something that I need to put some effort in today and get that back out. But yeah, you're right. Thank you for reminding me. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I need to tell you guys. Any other questions in this part? Okay, I think questions for this, we're gonna do a second day on distillation as well. So we'll do one day today, which is distillation basics. And then on Wednesday, the other part of this, what we would have given you is we would have given you a two component mixture. And the mixture was an unknown. We didn't tell you what was in the mixture. There were five different chemicals. It was hexane, cyclohexane, heptane, toluene, and ethylbenzene. And what you got was a two component mixture. And you were asked to work in pairs and to distill the two component mixture in two different systems. One using what's called a fractional column, a very long column. And then the other one in a simple distillation, which uses a short column. You were to distill them and collect two fractions, one at the beginning of the distillation and one at the end of the distillation. And then we saved those, we put them in the freezer. And then on the third day of the lab, once everybody was done, I taught everybody how to use the gas chromatography instruments, and we analyzed those samples and looked at how well the fractional column, the long column, achieved the separation versus the simple distillation using the short column. And the gas chromatography instruments were able to tell you percentage-wise how much of component A and how much of component B were in each one of the samples. And by comparing the fractional long column to the simple short column, you could see which of the two columns achieved a better separation based on the percentages in each of the samples that were taken. So I'll go through and I'll explain how that works. And we'll also explain how vacuum distillation works. And we'll go through vacuum distillation a little bit. So I think that's what we'll do on the next day. And then I'm going to have an easier time assigning questions for this one because I'm going to start using the appendices in the back of Pavia. And if you look in the back of Pavia under distillation, there is, I think it's section 13, 14, 15, appendix 13, appendix 14, appendix 15, that have distillation information within them. And they have questions at the end of those sections as well. And those questions are better than the in-chapter sections because they're about distillation more in general. And I think I'm going to look back and pull some of those questions from the TLC one in the back of Pavia. And what we'll do is rather than using the labs in Pavia so much, we'll switch to using the appendix within Pavia and using that as our instructional material and our instructional questions to a greater degree. And I think that's going to make things a lot easier on all of us. Because that gives you actually supplemental reading that you can go through and do as well, rather than just relying on the lab lecture, and then questions which are tied to that. So I think that's gonna be the better way to go, okay? But I'll get those questions together and we'll get them both out. Anything else from you guys for this morning? All right, if there's no further questions, then I propose that we adjourn for this morning, go take a half hour break, and we'll come back and we'll meet for lecture. And for lecture today, we'll be doing more on the optical activity and chiral molecules. And we'll be looking at how we differentiate between these two handed names and nomenclature and using the Kanningel-Prelog rules for things. All right, so I'll see you guys in a half hour in lecture, and we'll pick it up from there. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Francisco. Thanks, guys.
Hey, Jason. When do you have the exam corrections by?
Oh, wait. Ask the question again.
When did you want the exam corrections by?
Okay. Usually, I don't have a deadline for that. Usually, that's sort of open-ended. And it would be nice if you get them done before we have the second exam, which I'm guessing is going to be out at least 2 weeks, maybe three. But the sooner you do the exam corrections, the better. But I don't have a restriction on it.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Cool. Anybody else? All right, if there's no further questions, I'm going to end the session and I'll see you guys in half an hour. See you in a bit.